Votes have been counted in Zimbabwe and its victory for the incumbent president. The main opposition candidate refuses to accept the results.
He has repeated again, 2023, a coup on the ballot. We will not allow you to abuse people. You are not the only Zimbabwean. We are all Zimbabweans.
All ruled by the same party for over 40 years. Also, Chile wants Washington to declassify all documents related to the U.S. role in the 1973 coup.
We want simply to know exactly what was the role that the United States played at the time.
I'm Marco Werman. In Spain, tourists are back with a vengeance, making locals wish for quieter COVID days. And in France, demand for wine goes down. A sad solution, kill the surplus.
Wine is a cultural thing in France, and to decrease the supply of wine is not that easy.
All that and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for being with us today. We start in China, where the economy shows troubling signs of a continuing downward trend. That is not keeping the U.S. away from China, though. Today, Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo was in Beijing for talks with Chinese leaders.
We seek healthy competition with China, a growing Chinese economy that plays by the rules is in both of our interests.
Secretary Raimondo will also meet with business leaders. China and the U.S. share approximately $700 billion in trade. For what's at play in this economic relationship, we turn to Adam Posen. He's the president of the Peterson Institute for International Economics and joins us from Washington. Adam, can you start off by telling us more about Commerce Secretary Raimondo's trip to Beijing? What else came out of the meeting with her Chinese counterpart?
We're going to find out over time, Marco, what came out of the meeting, but the statement clip you just played is incredibly important. This is the strongest, clearest statement from the Biden administration cabinet that a growing trade in China is in both our interests, and the strongest statement that if China plays by the rules, we would have no problem with them engaging in trade with us. This is very different from Trump saying that we must get balanced trade irrespective of how China behaves, and it's very different from the earlier Biden administration approach of saying China's growth is a threat to the U.S. So I view this as a very positive move, more realistic.
And we should remember that Raimondo's trip to China comes on the heels of other recent high-level visits by three top Biden cabinet members, Secretary of State Blinken, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen, and Climate Envoy John Kerry. What would you say is the main driving factor for these three visits?
All of those are important. You're absolutely right. It has to be seen as an attempt to get a floor under the U.S.-China relationship and aspire to get progress made where we can agree. There had been loose talk early in the administration, including by Secretary Blinken, that we can walk and chew gum at the same time, we can have conflict and still cooperate, but you need a little bit of effort and communication to have cooperation. And so it's wonderful to see these senior Biden administration officials trying to engage their counterparts.
So why is it so important the U.S. continues to engage China on economic issues, especially now as the Chinese economy is shrinking?
It's about the role of China in the world and the specific sectors that China and the U.S. engage in. So on the first point, if China and the U.S. are really battling it out in the economic sphere, then we both waste a lot of money, we cost our people a lot of purchasing power, and importantly, particularly with respect to climate, we put a lot of developing countries in an awkward position of having to choose sides, which makes it harder to get deals on debt, on climate change, on the environment, as well as on simply decent treatment of workers. In terms of the specific sectors, there are key things that China makes that we don't want to make in the U.S. that require very cheap labor or very large scale and which are much more efficient to make in China. And if it's not a national security threat, we benefit from that.
Remind us why China's economy continues to struggle. Like, what are the key indicators you're looking at?
The obvious big one is that their real estate sector had a bubble and a bust, and some of their big real estate companies are going out of business and have huge loans unpaid. So that's like the U.S. in 2008 or Japan in the 90s. And that's a huge drag on the economy until you resolve who's going to pay for the losses, usually the government. There's also issues, though, as what I've argued, that the consumer in China seems to be much more scared than they are before COVID. They are buying less durable goods. They're putting more of their savings into bank accounts and liquid assets as opposed to risky things. And I would argue this is in part because President Xi and the Chinese Communist Party have been much more intrusive and aggressive and much more volatile in their treatment of the private sector, meaning average people, households, not just oligarchs.
Is the engagement between the U.S. and China something that is being supported by the top man, Xi Jinping, or is he sending out emissaries to talk with U.S. officials because if someone as high up as Gina Raimondo shows up, someone has to be talking to her?
I think it has backing from President Xi, because otherwise this wouldn't be happening. I mean, there was a long period there where there were no meetings between top Chinese officials and U.S. cabinet officials, at least no direct meetings in China. And I think Xi has at times, and the people around Xi have at times expressed frustration that they feel the U.S. has been too conflictual in its manner of approach to China and unwilling to work on areas of common interest. Now, some of that's rhetoric and propaganda, and some of that I think it's valid. But whatever is valid, Xi has indicated willingness to do this. I mean, the fact that his number two came out to meet Secretary Yellen when she arrived was a very big deal. They're signaling a willingness to talk. Whether they'll stick with it is a different question.
Meantime, China's also just wrapped up, as you know, these meetings with the other BRICS nations, Brazil, Russia, India, and South Africa. What does China hope will come out of those talks that might help it on the economic front?
The BRICS initiative is both a foreign policy and an economic initiative, Marco, as I know you've talked about. And so they are hoping to create more of a counterweight to the U.S. economy, both in terms of just being able to choose, have a little more room for choice and stability, but also to supplant things like the dominance of the dollar or the dominance of the U.S. over various international institutions. So it's an interesting initiative, but I don't think it's going to produce much in short-term results. It may help China to get steady streams of fossil fuels from Iran, Saudi, as well as Russia. And that would be the biggest short-term impact.
Finally, you said China is not falling apart. What is the economic forecast for China right now?
The economic forecast for China right now is slow growth by Chinese standards, which means something below 3% real year over year. But if President Xi chooses to stick with his technocratic approach of his advisors and is willing to bail out the banks, nothing that terrible should happen. The drag on growth, though, will probably persist for years to come.
Adam Posen, getting us going today. He's the president of the Peterson Institute for International Economics. He spoke to us from Washington. Adam, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me on The World.
Spain took a huge loss on tourist income during the COVID pandemic, but tourism there is now on the rebound. For people who rely on that revenue, it is a relief. But locals are now facing another challenge. Visitors are back with a vengeance and not always well-behaved. As the world's Jerry Haddon found out in Barcelona, many residents are pining for empty streets and the days of confinement.
There's a gourmet deli downtown, been around for over a century. It sells expensive cheese, Iberian ham, wine. But for a while this year, sales were way off. One day, says manager Tony Marino, I came out of the storeroom and there were some guys with a tripod set up in the middle of the store. They were speaking English, he says, and filming. Then they just left. The place is beautiful. Hardwood shelves, marble countertops, something from a bygone era. But folks were just coming in and taking selfies, Marino says. It was becoming a zoo. They weren't even saying hello, he says. Fed up a few months back, Marino went into his office and wrote up a little sign. It's still there, taped to the glass door. Just looking, it reads, €5 per person. We've never had to charge anyone, Merino says, but tourists got the message. No one's taking selfies anymore, he says. Our clients are really grateful. They don't have to wait for the tourists to leave just to come in. Like nearly everyone in Barcelona, Merino's not against tourists. He's just against too many of them, and they're sometimes less than civil behavior. This summer, a crowd of tens of thousands of revelers cheered on a drunken tourist in his underwear. It was shown on Spanish TV. The guy standing in a public fountain, swinging a street sign over his head. For better or worse, tourism in Spain is back. The country's on track to receive more than 83 million tourists this year. That was the record set just before the COVID pandemic. It's nearly twice Spain's population. It's bringing moments of mayhem, but it's also putting a lot of money in people's pockets, from apartment renters to cab drivers to owners of tourist drinking holes. One place where visitors drop lots of dough is along Barcelona's famous downtown esplanade, Las Ramblas. This summer, it has three times the officially allowed number of outdoor restaurant seats. Owners are willing to risk the fines, and it's clear why. I grab a seat amidst a sea of people speaking everything but Spanish. Everyone's drinking sangria. I ask my waiter how much for the big glass.
20 euro, 1 liter.
20 euros. I'll have a sparkling water.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
That's 22 bucks for a glass of cheap wine mixed with fruit. The Ramblas is tourist central, but aided by online top 10 listicles, festive foreigners are making their way into neighborhoods way off the beaten path.
Hola. Hola, buenas.
On a Barcelona hilltop known as the Bunkers, police come in daily to kick out the mostly young partiers. During the Spanish Civil War, there was an anti-aircraft battery up here. Now it's a city park and the place to go for sunset selfies, attracting people from all over the world.
Oh, my friend recommended back in Toronto.
This is Canadian tourist Rala Liu.
I wish I knew that they're closing early. They should update their hours on Google Maps or something so all these people know to come early.
The park never used to close at all. Now police lock the high iron gate the city has installed around it.
Cuando se marche la urbana, vuelven a aparecer.
As soon as the police leave, they'll be back, says neighbor Nati Mesa, walking her dog Simba. They party up there all night. And look, here comes the neighborhood bus, she says. It's filled with tourists. We who actually live up here, she says, sometimes can't even get home. Fencing off popular spots is just one way the city's trying to rein in the party. It's also banned organized pub crawls in the old city. Police dole out fines for indecent behavior. But what no city can control? The number of visitors. But you can try to spread the tourists around, taking the pressure off the overrun areas. Take a new library named after the late Colombian writer Gabriel García Márquez. On a recent day, it's crowded, but mainly with locals. Librarian Miami Ponce says she's thrilled.
It's normal, pero la gente se comporta muy bien, ¿eh? Lo que pasa que, claro, cuando son muchos, pues...
Even if at times it gets a little noisy, she says. We need to call for quiet, she says, but mostly people here behave well. The city chose the site for the library some 20 minutes from downtown, in a working-class neighborhood called San Martí, far off the tourism circuit. For now, at least. The wood and glass structure just won Best New Public Library in the world. If it makes the listicles, the selfie mobs might just make the trek out here. And, like the overrun downtown deli, it'll have to get creative to protect the residents who come here to actually use it. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon in Barcelona.
Let's take a moment to catch up on the fast-moving scandal that has engulfed Spanish soccer in the past week. On Friday, we reported that the star of Spain's national women's soccer team had not consented to a public kiss that the president of the Spanish Soccer Federation forced on her after the squad's victory in the Women's World Cup. Federation President Luis Rubiales has remained defiant despite the growing support for player Jenny Hermoso. Soccer's global governing body, FIFA, suspended Rubiales for 90 days while it investigates the incident. Some government ministers have called for his removal as well. And today, Spanish prosecutors launched an investigation into whether the incident constituted an act of sexual aggression. As for the Spanish Soccer Federation itself, it remains in solidarity with its embattled president. The federation reportedly asked to be suspended by Europe's governing body of soccer, UEFA, in an effort to provoke public opinion in support of Rubiales. Either he keeps his job or Spain does not get to compete. UEFA reportedly dismissed that request. Also strongly behind Rubiales, his mom. She began a hunger strike in a church today to protest what she called the inhumane hounding of her son. When it comes to the players on the field, their stance is unanimous. The entire World Cup winning team says it refuses to play while Rubiales remains in power. And that's your Monday soccer update. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Last week, more than 4 million people in Zimbabwe went to the ballot box to elect a new president. On Saturday, the results were announced. Incumbent president Emmerson Mnangagwa was declared the winner. The country's opposition, though, has not accepted the results and plans to challenge, as The World's Africa correspondent Halima Gikande reports.
After incumbent president Emmerson Mnangagwa was announced the winner of last week's election, he praised his country for becoming a, quote, mature democracy after many years of struggle.
The democracy and the right we have exercised through our vote was paid for by the supreme sacrifice of many sons and daughters of our great country, Zimbabwe.
The sacrifice he's referring to is the years-long fight that he and his party, the ZANU-PF, fought against white minority rule 40 years ago. The ZANU-PF has ruled the country ever since. In 2017, Mnangagwa helped unseat from power his former ally, liberation hero-turned-dictator Robert Mugabe. Mnangagwa has promised a better Zimbabwe.
Together, as one united people, we shall continue on the growth trajectory witnessed over the last 5 years.
But for many Zimbabweans, these past 5 years have been marked by regression, high inflation, corruption, and oppression. Nelson Chamisa, who came in second place, has called Mnangagwa's win a fraud.
He has repeated again, 2023, a coup on the ballot. You can't survive this for far too many times. This time, no further. We've drawn a line in the sand. We will not allow you to abuse people.
Chamisa has been running on a platform of change and ending corruption. While he hasn't officially accepted the results, he has called on electoral reform.
We need to find a permanent answer to electoral reforms going forward so that elections mean peace. Elections mean credibility. Elections mean legitimacy. As we speak, elections mean war. Elections mean intimidation.
Observer missions in Zimbabwe have said this election was largely peaceful, but noted serious issues. Nevers Mumba is the former vice president of Zambia. He heads the electoral observation mission of the regional organization SADC, or Southern African Development Community. He said they confirmed the existence of a shadowy group called Forever Associates Zimbabwe that's believed to be a quasi-security intelligence organization.
These and other unidentified persons who were not polling officials were also observed taking down the voters' names before they cast their votes. In some areas, voters were intimidated by the actions of these individuals.
SADC's preliminary report concluded that some parts of the election did not meet regional standards. The European Union's electoral mission also cited intimidation, violence, and an unfair playing field in their preliminary review. Zimbabwe's acting foreign affairs and international trade minister, Eamon Moruira, has shot back at critics.
This, we believe, is a gross interference in the internal affairs of a sovereign state and therefore totally unacceptable.
He did, however, acknowledge minor glitches in the election, including late distribution of voting materials. For The World, I'm Halima Gikandi in Nairobi.
I'll bet you didn't see this coming, and yet it happens all the time, apparently. France has announced plans to destroy millions of gallons of wine. There are many reasons behind the decision, and we'll get into that. But just think of all those bottles of Pinot Noir, Merlot, Chablis, and Cabernet. It's hard to picture the scale of the destruction, but Olivier Jargot understands it. He's a professor of economics at Kedge Business School in Bordeaux in France and has been following the news. He joins us from New York. Olivier, the European Union has paid France about $172 million to destroy 80 million gallons of wine, I see. So now the French government has announced additional funds to get rid of even more wine. What is behind all this?
Yeah, that is a temporary situation. The problem is that there is a surplus of wine in some regions, essentially Bordeaux and Languedoc. It concerns mostly red wines and pink wines, and not really Chardonnay and fancy wines produced around Chablis or in other fancy regions like Burgundy. But this is a real concern, and a lot of money has been put on the table to get rid of these wines. And what will be done essentially is that producers will receive the money and they will distill some of their wines into pure alcohol that will later be used to produce perfumes or to make cleaning supplies, for example.
Very kind of fascinating kind of evolution of wine to cleaning materials. But so the French government is basically trying to engineer the price of red and rosé to be higher. Is that right?
Yeah, indeed, this will have an impact on the quantity of wine circulating in the market. So less supply means higher prices. That's the idea of retrieving some wines from the market to boost prices and help producers find sources of revenue again.
So is all of this happening because people are just drinking less wine in France?
Temporarily, yes, that's one explanation. Less demand for wine temporarily because of food prices now that are higher compared to before due to this inflation phenomenon that we had to deal with this year. So that's a temporary situation. But in the long run, we drink less and less wine in France. So as to illustrate this, in 1926, the average French citizen used to drink 136 liters of wine per year. It's now only 40 liters per year. It's a huge difference. So we have to deal with this declining demand. It's not easy to adapt to this situation because wine is a cultural thing in France. And to decrease the supply of wine is not that easy when you established a vineyard a long time ago. That's difficult.
Olivier, can you tell us why and when the demand started to drop for wine in France?
A long, long time ago, so this is not a new phenomenon. The younger generation is less interested in drinking wine than my generation, for instance. And the younger generation, say Gen Z, for instance, they're interested in drinking other beverages like beer or spirits more than wine. At the same time, the interesting thing is that the younger generation wants to drink more organic wines, cleaner wines of higher quality. So they drink less, but they drink better.
And what will become of the conventional wine growers and winemakers?
I think there is less demand for these entry-level wines. This is what's happening now. So we're not talking about distilling high-quality wines in France. We're distilling entry-level quality wines in France.
For the growers and winemakers, how are they responding to this planned destruction of their wine?
There was a huge demand for these subsidies from producers. They're not, of course, happy to see their wines distilled and going out of the market. It's never good news, of course, but they really need this help in the short run to survive.
Olivier Gergaud is a professor of economics at Kedge Business School in Bordeaux, France, giving us background on plans by the French government to destroy millions of gallons of wine. Olivier, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. It's not easy to move from your home country. There's only so much space in your bag to hold what's precious.
We immigrants, we learn to carry things. We pack and unpack, and we take our homes with us.
It's often the small things that matter the most, like a single sausage. That's still ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Syrians are back on the streets demanding the removal of President Bashar al-Assad. They are unhappy about the worsening economic situation there. Over the past couple of weeks, the protests have been growing, even in government-controlled areas in the south of the country. Syria's economy has been in free fall for the past few years. Inflation has skyrocketed and wages have been stagnant. As we hear in this report from The World's Shirin Jafari, Syrians are fed up.
In the span of a decade, Syria went from what the World Bank calls a middle-income country to a low-income country.
I believe the Syrian economy hasn't been this vulnerable, this fragile, since World War I.
Karam Shahar is a senior fellow with the New Lines Institute, a nonpartisan think tank in Washington, D.C.
It's in a terrible state, at the verge of collapse.
There are no reliable government statistics in Syria, Shahar says, but he estimates that the price of goods have gone up 30 times since 2011. That year was the start of the Syrian uprisings, where thousands of people came out to the streets demanding an end to the government of Bashar al-Assad. What followed was a brutal crackdown on the protesters and about a decade of conflict in Syria. Whole cities were destroyed, civilians were gassed and starved to death, thousands are still missing or detained. Assad managed to stay in power with the help of Russia and Iran, but the demands of the people didn't go away.
The salary of a public sector employee, as we speak, wouldn't exceed $20 per month.
Shahar says that's enough to buy about 8 pounds of meat, a major staple in Syrians' diets.
That's it. It can't cover anything else. It can't cover anything related to transportation or accommodation or education and so on.
He says more people walk to work these days instead of taking public transportation because that's cheaper. Some have no choice but to take on second jobs. For the past 7 days, demonstrations have picked up once again in parts of Syria. Some of the chants echo those of the early days of the uprisings. They call Bashar al-Assad a liar and they want him to resign. In this video posted online from the southern city of Suwayda, a young woman tells the crowd that people's demands have always been political. She says they want their dignity and freedom back. Mohammed Al-Ghanem is with the American Coalition for Syria, a group of NGOs in the U.S. that focus on aid and reforms in Syria. He says these protests are significant because they show that Syrians are once again challenging Assad and his government, despite knowing too well what they are capable of.
You know, what's happening in Syria at the moment puts the lie to a lot of the claims that we've seen over the past couple of years that Bashar al-Assad has won, Bashar al-Assad is victorious, that the Syrian people are just fatigued and they're unwilling or unable to challenge the Assad regime again.
Ghanem points out that even some of those who supported Assad in the past are now speaking out against him.
And this is a very, very significant development because if Assad can't maintain support within his own base, this is incredibly bad news for the regime.
Abdul Kafi Anhamdo, an activist I reach in the northwest of Syria, tells me he supports the protests in the south. He says some of those speaking out today stayed silent or backed the government in the past.
This is the kind of a freedom we have called for in 2011, is that when you are angry, that when you don't receive your rights, when you think things are going wrong, you can speak out.
The Assad government blames Western sanctions for the currency collapse and the worsening economy. But Karam Shahar of New Lines Institute says the Syrian people are no longer buying that excuse.
They are now convinced that Bashar al-Assad and his regime and his cronies are the party most responsible for their suffering. That could actually mean the end of the regime, or that's at least the most promising sign that the regime is vulnerable.
Shahar says the only way out of the instability in Syria is through a political settlement. But previous attempts at negotiations between all sides have failed. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
The people of Chile are petitioning to get their history back. They've been calling on foreign governments to release all classified documents related to the bleak anniversary they'll observe next month. That anniversary will mark 50 years since a CIA-backed coup toppled the government of the democratically elected president, Salvador Allende. In recent days, the U.S. State Department has declassified two coup-related daily briefings that landed on President Richard Nixon's desk in 1973, just before the coup. Chile's ambassador in the U.S., Juan Gabriel Valdez, says that's not enough. He joins me from Washington. Ambassador Valdez, tell us first, if you would, about the documents that the U.S. government has just released. These are daily briefings, we know, that landed on President Nixon's desk, one on the day of the coup, September 11, 73, and another from 3 days prior. They've been kept secret until now. What's in them?
Well, the documents are very brief. President Nixon is informed that President Allende has been killed or has died or has committed suicide, the CIA is not sure, all resistance to the coup has been eliminated. There is no mention to the bombing of the presidential palace. There is a very cold picture of what happens, and I think that the main explanation for that is that President Nixon had been so much involved in the Chilean situation during the previous years, that there was no point of explaining to him exactly what the general picture was.
Are these the sorts of documents that the U.S. Embassy in Santiago would have cabled to the State Department and then sent on to the White House for the president's daily briefing?
I suppose so. I suppose that these documents come from the CIA station in Chile, and they were communicated to the president. Now, we already have the text of conversations between the president and Mr. Kissinger, which are much more clear than these documents in terms of the level of interest and alarm that the U.S. government at the time felt vis-a-vis the situation in Chile and the election of Salvador Allende.
I mean, that's a great point, because it doesn't seem like there is any sort of smoking gun in these recently declassified documents. So why do you think the U.S. government held onto them for nearly half a century?
This is a very good question. I think that it's difficult to explain why these documents were secret when they only describe a situation that we already knew.
What other documents, though, related to General Augusto Pinochet's 73 coup does your government want released?
The Church Committee, for instance, had an enormous amount of information on Chile, which has not been yet declassified. And this doesn't depend apparently on the government itself. It depends on Congress.
The Church Committee, of course, that was the investigative committee that Senator Frank Church led about a year and a half after the coup.
1975, yes. Therefore, we are waiting the date in which these documents can be known. But we also want to have information about the conversation that President Nixon had with the president of Brazil at the time, the military dictatorship in Brazil, President Garastazu Medici, because according to Brazilian sources, in that meeting, President Nixon asked General Garastazu Medici to take care of the support to the military in case of a military coup in Chile. And the information we have on people that were killed in the following days to the coup is that there were people speaking in Portuguese in the National Stadium and in other prisons at the time. There are many things we don't know yet and we would like to explore.
What about the timing of this declassification, Ambassador, happening as it does just a couple of weeks before the 50th anniversary of the coup? What do you make of that?
Well, I think that we have been in Chile very, very active in asking for these documents. And we are grateful to the governments of President Obama, President Clinton, and President Biden for their assistance on this, because I think that it represents not simply support to the Chileans who want to reconstruct what happened in these tragic days, but it also represents the level of transparency we want to see in our friendship, which is today extremely solid and consistent. We have a future in common, but we have a history in the past which divided us in a very tragic way, and we want simply to know exactly what was the role that the United States played at the time.
Ambassador, the 1973 coup really cleaved Chile in two and traumatized the country for many years. Is this whole undertaking, trying to get all these documents released and recovering painful parts of your country's history, is it something that has united the left and right in Chile?
No. I think that the country, unfortunately, continues to be divided by the coup. This division is something that we would like to overcome. Reconstructing history has the merit of allowing everybody to participate in a common discussion. We cannot correct what happened, but at least if we know what happened, we know exactly where the responsibilities on the tragic events in Chile. We need to be able to condemn any attempt against democratic institutions and any threat against democratic institutions that comes from violence. And therefore, in order to do that, we have to observe what happened in Chile and why is it that it continues to divide us.
That's Chile's ambassador to the U.S., Juan Gabriel Valdez. He's been speaking with us about classified documents the U.S. State Department has finally released nearly 50 years after the coup in Chile, and more documents still not declassified wanted by his government. Ambassador, thank you very much.
It was a pleasure.
Moving to a new country means packing up your life, literally getting all your stuff into bags and boxes, and psychologically preparing for the new life you'll have somewhere else.
We immigrants, we learn to carry things. We pack and unpack, and we take our homes with us.
Teacher Eva Krushciel knows this personally. In Stories from the Stage, a production from our partners at GBH Boston, Eva shared the comical side of what she carried with her when she came to the U.S. from Poland. Here's more from Eva's story.
I once took a sausage with me. A Polish sausage, mind you. It might not taste any different from American or Israeli sausage, but it's a Polish sausage. I bought it at the airport before I left Poland, and it was sealed tightly, so I thought it was okay. And then on the flight, I sort of started to have bad premonitions. So I asked a flight attendant, and she told me to eat it right away.
but I fell asleep instead. And I only woke when it was time to exit the flight. So I promised myself to throw the sausage away in the nearest bathroom, and I kept walking. I grew up in the communist regime, and the food was scarce, and I don't like to waste food. So I kept walking, thinking, if God lets my sausage in, I will eat it like a saint. Circle a table with Gregorian chants. So the baggage carousel spat my luggage out, and I looked around, and I quickly transferred my sausage from carry-on to the checked luggage. And I kept walking towards the customs, praying for my sausage. And the officer pulled me aside, and my luggage went through a sausage scan. And he said, what is it? And I said, it's a sealed sausage. I said it with a pride. And he said, but you declared no meat. And I said, sealed sausage is not a meat. Sealed sausage is a sealed sausage. He looked puzzled. So I repeated with determination. Sealed sausage is a sealed sausage. And he looked blinded, as if this hypnotic alliteration threw him back into the waters of his childhood, where perhaps eels jiggle Scottish dances. So in the end, my sausage got arrested. And I had to promise that I understood that sausage was a meat. Had it not been confiscated, perhaps I would have sent it to the Vatican to become a relic. And this sausage incident gave me a desire, an appetite for more. As I started to research the things that immigrants carry with them. And I went actually a few times to Ellis Island to track the historical objects. And they carried barrels of pickles, goose feathers. They carried Bibles. They carried rosaries, honeymoon dresses, live goats. There was a Swedish woman who carried a stained sheet used in her family to give birth only. And she wanted to show it to her new doctor. And then I thought, what were the invisible things that they carried or they were sneaking through the customs? Albert Sabin, a pauper from Białystok in Poland, carried a live virus, the vaccine that eliminated polio from the United States. Kahil Gibral, an Arab, carried a live virus of poetry that soon became his famous book, The Prophet. Paula Negri carried the dreams of stardom, and she became a Hollywood star. So we immigrants like to carry things, and we do not throw easily away cheese wrappers and glass jars from our country. And you could wonder, what do those silly attachments stand for? I think they stand for something much bigger. It could be our desire to not to lose our identity or a desire to find a new identity. So you might say, I lost my sausage, but I found the poetics of smuggling. Thank you.
The poetics of smuggling. I love that. That was teacher Eva Cruciel with her story about what she and other immigrants carry with them when they leave home. Cruciel appeared in Stories from the Stage, a program where ordinary people tell extraordinary stories, produced by the GBH-TV network World. You can hear more Stories from the Stage at worldchannel.org. When we hear about Crimea these days, it's usually in the context of war. After all, Russia invaded Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula in 2014 and has occupied it ever since, including through its full-scale invasion of the country last year. But when Ukrainians hear the name Crimea, they often think of a place that's a bastion of culture and music. One of Ukraine's most famous singers is known simply as Jamala. She won the Eurovision Song Contest in 2016. Jamala is a Crimean Tatar, a group indigenous to that part of the country. She often talks about how that heritage shapes her music.
My name is Jamal. I'm a singer and songwriter from Ukraine, from the brave Ukraine. My whole family are musicians. My mom, she is a piano teacher. My father, he is an accordion player, and he is a really good folk singer. He sings Crimean Tatar songs. And I remember that father with mother, they sang this song, Bizim Taraf. Bizim Taraf, it means my side. Bizim Taraf, Bizim Taraf. It was like full of the emotions just immediately. In our family, we have so many musical genres, and we were free to play, to sing everything, jazz, opera, folk, rock, I don't know, whatever. You have to be free, listen every style of music. And then I start to write my own music. And nowadays I released my huge work. It's album Khrim. It means Crimea. Than 80 musicians work on this album. It's double symphony orchestra plus folk musicians plus 14 ancient Crimean Tatar songs from Crimea. It's like a diary. Through this song, we can read the characters. For example, Ali Maidamah, it was like the main character in 17th century. He was like Robin Hood. He fighting for the rights for the poor people, and he helped them. And the belief in his strength was so huge. Yeah, yes, mom, I love this song. It's absolutely unique stories. I create this album as a soundtrack. A lot of cinematography inspiration from Hans Zimmer or Ramin Djawadi, because, you know, the Game of Thrones, they built 7 kingdoms with the different melodies, and we feel it in the music. Oh, my God, it was a real inspiration for me, because it's not just one song from the Crimea. It's real 14 characters. This song, my great-grandmother told me. In that time, all men and women, they try to find a couple in their villages. And if you listen carefully to this song, you understand that in the beginning, you hear that this girl waiting for her boyfriend through the window. And the tragedy is that he didn't come. And nowadays, it sounds okay, whatever, I'll find another one. But in that time, it was huge tragedy. You crushed my heart, and we feel it in the end of the song. For me, when I almost ended the mixing of the album and the full war started, I had a dream. I had a dream that in the end of the album, to be honest with my listeners, I had to add what happened with album
because when the full-scale war started, my album was in the center of Kyiv, under attack, literally. I couldn't reach it. That's why I add this sound that happened in Bucha, Mariupol, because in that time we went through this sounds. And I'm really proud of this work because it's something real. Russians can steal our territory nowadays, but they can steal our identity, our songs. And for me, it's really important that no matter what, despite of shelling, I want to say to the whole world that we exist. And for me, it's important to give a voice to my homeland, Crimea.
That's the Ukrainian and Crimean Tatar singer Jamala. Her newest album is called Khum, which, as she explained, means Crimea. Our story was produced by The World's Daniel Hoffman. Join us tomorrow on The World for a different kind of musical story from Ukraine, with a composer who's capturing everyday sounds beyond the war, a sonic journey through the capital city, drawing inspiration from birds, buses, even grocery store cash registers. The sounds of Ukraine put to music, that's tomorrow on The World. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.